This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. COVID-19 restrictions in the U.S. are mostly gone, but the coronavirus is not, and now the Delta variant is causing widespread concern about new vulnerabilities, even for those of us who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. Columbus Dispatch reporter Max Philby explains the situation here as we start our weekly news review. He's on the phone. Max, thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
So I saw a map this morning circulating on Twitter citing health departments indicating that every state but Montana is seeing an increase week over week in positive COVID-19 cases. Can you tell us what we're seeing in Ohio?
Yeah, so in Ohio, our cases have remained fairly stable as of late. We've started to near the 500 daily case mark again recently, but for the most part, for the last week or two, we've been staying below that. So definitely things seem to be ticking up slightly, but not exploding here yet.
Do we know what role this Delta variant is playing in that?
Yeah, so among all variants of the virus in Ohio, the Delta variant has actually only been identified as 1% of the variants found. But, and this is a little confusing here, of total cases, it accounts for about 15% of cases so far in Ohio. So it wouldn't be surprising if we see that increase in the next few weeks.
So what are health officials saying about it, that we need to be on the lookout for this, that maybe we need to proceed with a little more caution than we had been over the past several weeks, maybe months?
Yeah, so, I mean, their number one message, you know, has been get vaccinated. By all accounts, the vaccines that are on the market in the U.S. today still all protect against the Delta variant for the most part. You know, you don't need a booster or anything yet. That's the main message they're sending out there.
So what did we know about these newer infections as it relates to people who have been vaccinated versus those who haven't? Do we have data on that?
So there's some just starting to trickle out. Mainly we're seeing these cases in people who are unvaccinated. So if you are vaccinated, you know, no vaccine is 100% effective, although some of these get pretty close. There's still a possibility you could get infected, but it seems unlikely at this point. Now, this Delta variant, it is considered far more contagious than any previous strains of the virus. So if you're not vaccinated, there's potentially a better chance that you could catch this one. But there's not really a clear sign yet as to whether it causes more serious infection or not. There's just not enough data out there on that yet.
We're talking with Max Philby of the Columbus Dispatch about the Delta variant COVID-19 here in Ohio. So, Max, in your report, and as our conversation started, you noted that we haven't seen a whole lot of cases of Delta variant in Ohio so far, but you did report that Missouri has also seen a rise in infection. You cite the Kansas City Star saying that the Delta variant accounted for 91% of all cases tested as of July 12. Are there models or concerns out of these other states being considered here in Ohio?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, doctors told me that some of these states that are seeing the current spikes in coronavirus are states that are not very highly vaccinated. You know, some of these states, Mississippi for one, too, is, I think, somewhere in the mid to upper 30 percentile range for the number of people vaccinated there. In Ohio, you know, we're closing in on 50%, but that's still sort of on the lower end nationwide. So I think that, you know, some doctors have told me that there's a possibility we could see outbreaks like that in Ohio. Hopefully not quite as bad, though, since we're closer to 50%.
I think back to the beginning of the year when the states were rolling out the vaccine in a tiered fashion. So you had to meet certain criteria, either age or possibly profession, before you could get in line. And those of us who wanted to be vaccinated as quickly as possible were lining up just as fast as they'd let us. And as you know, we're about at 50% statewide in Ohio for vaccinated population. What are health officials saying about the way it's kind of dropped off? I mean, you can't run into a store, it seems like, anymore without seeing a sign or an opportunity to be vaccinated, and people don't appear to be taking advantage of it anymore.
Sure, yeah. So a doctor I just spoke to the other day said, well, you know, we kind of went through this period where everybody who really wanted to get vaccinated got vaccinated. And then we were kind of in the midst of, convincing people who were sort of on the fence or a little hesitant about it to get it. Now we're kind of in this phase where we really have this last group of people who just may not get vaccinated for whatever reason, who are just so hesitant that they haven't been, you know, kind of reached yet or convinced yet. A doctor I spoke to the other day said this could be a real problem. Like I said, it could lead to a spike in infections here in the near future. Other doctors I've spoken with have said that we could see kind of our, you know, perhaps our final last big surge of coronavirus this fall as people head back indoors without masks on.
So we've been hearing about booster shots, and originally we just, I think it seemed like we just assumed that, yeah, we're eventually going to need a booster shot on this. Then some data came out recently suggesting that the current vaccines, as we know them, could provide years-long protection against COVID-19. What have you learned about the need for a booster shot?
Sure. So, I mean, all things considered, the jury's still sort of out on that, simply because the vaccines that everybody's taken for this virus have not been around, more than 7-8 months. So we'll see, but you're correct. There are studies that show that this immunity from the vaccine could last, you know, potentially 3-4 years, something like that. Now I know Pfizer announced, I believe it was a week or two ago, that they were pursuing, authorization for a potential COVID booster shot. Now they actually were pretty strongly rebuffed by, the CDC and the FDA, who put out a joint statement saying, you know, there is no need for a booster just yet. We're tracking everything. And if we think that the science shows that it's needed, we'll be first to tell you. But as of right now, no booster needed.
So have we seen anything related to boosters and protection specifically against the Delta variant? Has anyone suggested that a booster shot in your current vaccine might offer added protection against these new emerging variants?
Yeah, no. So I think that thought has definitely been floated out there. Like I said, that most officials don't believe that you need a booster right now for the Delta variant, but there is some concern that eventually we could have a variant that, not necessarily this year or in the very near future, but that we could have a variant at some point that is able to somehow, you know, slip past this vaccine immunity that we've all got, hopefully, or most of us have got now. And so that's the idea why there might be a booster needed at some point. Either the immunity we all have kind of wears off over time, or we get another variant that is a little trickier and able to slide by the vaccine that we have right now.
We all saw our lives disrupted over the course of the pandemic, and we all experienced things perhaps that we hadn't experienced before. And one very common piece of that was wearing a face mask, particularly when we were in public, where there would be people that were not in households with. And now that's ended. The mask mandates are gone, and we're seeing each other's faces again. It's been a very welcome sign that perhaps we're on the better side of the pandemic, if not yet the other side. However, I'm reading that Los Angeles County, the most populous county in the United States, is now suggesting that face masks may need to return as the Delta variant in particular starts to emerge there. What are we hearing in Ohio from people in positions of public trust and public health as it relates to face masks?
Sure. So you're correct. I think L.A. County, that was just in the last day or two due to a dramatic rise in cases there. Locally in Ohio, the mask mandate remains non-existent right now. It was dropped earlier this year. Officials have largely said, you know, if you're vaccinated, you don't really need to worry at this point. You don't have to wear a mask. There's no requirement to wear a mask right now in Ohio if you are unvaccinated, but if you're going out in public, you're in large crowds, you're doing things, it's strongly recommended that if for whatever reason you haven't been vaccinated yet, that you wear a mask just to protect yourself and you know, to keep yourself from potentially spreading the virus to others if you catch it.
Max Philby is a reporter with the Columbus Dispatch. Max, thanks so much for taking some time and sharing your reporting with us today. We appreciate it.
No problem.
And up next, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is up for re-election next year. He's drawn a challenge from a prominent Democrat in Kentucky. And later, the new documentary revisiting the Covington Catholic National Mall encounter from 2019. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. U.S. Senator Rand Paul, the Republican from Kentucky, is up for re-election next year. And already, a campaign against him is heating up. Paul is answering. Career Journal reporter Morgan Watkins is with us to talk about the race and the newly launched campaign of Democratic former state representative Charles Booker. Morgan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So Rand Paul is somebody that we're probably mostly familiar with at this point. He's in his second term there in the United States Senate, had a presidential campaign in the 2016 Republican primary. So he's got a pretty good profile. Charles Booker is probably mostly known to Kentucky voters for finishing runner up in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate seat last year, was won by Amy McGrath, who went on to be trounced by Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell. So tell us, or remind us if necessary, who is Charles Booker?
Yeah, so Charles Booker, he has been a state representative in the Kentucky legislature. He served, finished his term up at the end of last year, actually. He essentially gave up his seat in order to run against Senator McConnell last year. So he jumped in the race in January of last year, and it was really in maybe the last month or so leading up to the primary, which got delayed because of COVID, that he really exploded into sort of getting some national spotlight because of the protests against police brutality and racism and over the death of Breonna Taylor that we had in Louisville. He was really a prominent public figure who came to those protests, took part in those, and got some major endorsements from people like Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and he did finish runner up in the Democratic primary and lost to Amy McGrath, but he lost by not very much. You know, it was a really close race, a lot closer than anyone expected. And after that, people were keeping their eyes on him and wondering if he was going to run again. And he answered that pretty resoundingly this month, saying, yeah, he's definitely running again.
So Amy McGrath was able to get into that primary on the Democratic side earlier than anyone else. And because she was running against Mitch McConnell, who obviously has strong support from Republicans, he's not liked by Democrats. So she was receiving a ton of money from all over the country. So she started with a heavy fundraising advantage and some name recognition from a congressional run that she had also lost in the cycle prior. What do we know that might be different for Charles Booker this time, with him entering the race sort of as the first higher profile candidate to jump in the primary?
Well, he's definitely jumping in a lot earlier this time than he did against Senator McConnell. So that certainly will help him, because it definitely helped Amy McGrath to be the first prominent person throwing their hat in the ring. He did a kind of an exploratory committee where he sort of had put some feelers out, made it clear that he was thinking about running against Rand Paul, and started to sort of raise some money, get some interest, and then officially kicked off his campaign this month. So getting in early is really helpful for him. And to a large extent, I mean, he's still got, you know, a lot of excitement around him that he generated last year. Since he lost the primary last year, he's been working. He formed a nonprofit called From the Hood to the Holler. That was his big campaign slogan, was From the Hood to the Holler, kind of bringing people across Kentucky together to fight poverty, generational poverty, especially. And so, yeah, for him, like, he's still been around doing things like that, been a big voice on social media, where he's amassed quite the following. He's got over 300,000 followers on there. So he definitely has a platform to jump off of now that he built largely thanks to his run last year.
That Hood to the Holler reference, he is from West Louisville, a historically black neighborhood in Kentucky's largest city. And then the Holler, of course, a reference to the more rural parts of the state. That was something he emphasized, that he would be an urban black man going into Appalachia and trying to connect with voters there to show the similar economic issues that they face. And do we expect that type of campaign strategy in next year's campaign?
100%. Yeah, he has he's dusted off that campaign slogan again. He's very much focused on a lot of the same issues that he was in his run last year. So he hasn't come in with a totally different, you know, set of policy goals or anything. He's very much saying, you know, I ran on this last year. We didn't quite make it in terms of the primary, but I'm running again. I've got the same platform essentially, and really arguing that generational poverty is something that afflicts Kentuckians of all backgrounds all across the state, and that's something that he thinks he can unite people on.
When we look back at the past four U.S. Senate races in Kentucky, they haven't been particularly close. Mitch McConnell easily beat Amy McGrath last year, and Rand Paul's previous election 5 years ago, he defeated Lexington Mayor Jim Gray quite comfortably. And then Mitch McConnell beat then Secretary of State Allison Grimes pretty handily. And Rand Paul won his first election comfortably over then Attorney General Jack Conway. Is there something different in the water, perhaps, for Charles Booker if he should win the nomination that might change the fortunes for Democrats in these federal races?
It's going to be tough. I mean, Kentucky, no question, has become increasingly conservative over the years. So any Democrat winning a statewide race, for Senate is going to be hard. We haven't had a Democratic senator since the early 90s. But what you will see if Booker wins the Democratic primary is he's going to run a different race. You know, Amy McGrath and some of the prior candidates, they really ran more as moderate Democrats trying to pull some Republican voters away, or conservative voters anyway, away from the Republican candidate. And Booker is unabashedly progressive. You know, he's out there promoting things like Medicare for all. He's been upfront about that he thinks that a progressive candidate can win and can put a different message out there, essentially. And so it's certainly, if he's going to put that to the test and really focus a lot on, obviously he's doing a lot of fundraising, but also he said that he's really focusing on grassroots efforts. But no question, I mean, it's going to be tough for any Democrat to win, but at the very least, it's going to be a very different race for people, and folks are going to see something that they haven't typically seen from Democratic challengers.
Probably safe to assume that as of today, Charles Booker would be a front runner for the Democratic nomination. And as you note, the other candidates previously were considered more moderate traditional Democrats, whereas Charles Booker identifies with the progressive movement across the country. Is there a lane for a moderate candidate to jump in that primary as well? So we might see a repeat of the McGrath-Booker campaign from 2020. Are we hearing about any candidates possibly dipping their toes in the water or exploring?
Sure. He's not the only candidate in the race right now. And definitely there's a lane for maybe someone who's well-known and moderate to try to jump in. It's still early. You know, in this case, Booker kind of did a smart move by jumping in early, kind of putting his face out there, getting his name out there, and building up support. But it's still early days. I mean, this is a 2022 race. So there's plenty of time for him to get a moderate challenger and to have to maybe prove himself and win in that battle before he moves on to facing off against Rand Paul. But in his messaging, I mean, he's making clear from the start, just the way Amy McGrath did last time, he's running against Rand Paul, and that's what his messaging is focusing on.
We noted that it's been quite a while since a Democrat held a U.S. Senate seat representing Kentucky and Washington. It's never happened that a Black person has represented Kentucky in the federal delegations. Charles Booker is a Black man, and race appears to have entered this campaign already. Can you talk a little bit about Republican incumbent Senator Rand Paul and some messaging that he's put out that has drawn criticism from the Booker campaign?
Sure. So when Booker launched his campaign at the beginning of this month, Senator Paul was actually in Louisville doing some other events, and reporters, myself and others, obviously asked him about Booker officially jumping in the race. And he really had a message that day that he really stuck to, which was, he said, look, I don't think reparations for slavery or defunding the police are going to be popular with Kentucky voters. And even when pressed on, well, what about the other aspects of Booker's campaign? He really stayed focused on those two issues in particular. Then that was compounded by the fact that his campaign sent out an email the day after Booker launched his campaign, where basically Senator Paul's campaign put out an email saying, a racial left opponent is challenging me. A source close to the campaign told me that that was a typo, that it was supposed to say radical, a radical left opponent, not a racial left opponent. But of course, that email raised eyebrows. Booker very quickly put out a fundraising email of his own saying that Rand Paul was making it clear how he felt about someone like Booker jumping into the race. So certainly that those things together in particular really kind of sparked some discussion about whether this was an example of dog whistle politics or not.
You do note in your reporting, Morgan, that the email subject line did say the radical left, but the body of the messaging said racial left. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
So what has the reactions been? I know you talked to several people in the political circles across Kentucky about, or and elsewhere, about reactions to this and how race might play in. And what did you learn?
I talked to a Berkeley law professor who wrote a book about dog whistle politics, which essentially is where you use coded language to raise the specter of race, but in a way that allows for plausible deniability, that's what you're doing. It's something that we've seen a lot over the decades in American politics. And, you know, the Berkeley law professor said, yeah, he thinks that this, you know, Senator Paul's initial response to Booker's campaign absolutely falls into that category in terms of that tactic. You know, I did speak, and Booker has said openly, he said that he thinks that Senator Paul is stoking racism as a campaign tactic, and that he disagrees that that's going to be successful in Kentucky. And Booker saying, look, not only do we have to beat Paul, we have to beat hate. But, you know, I talked to some other folks who said, you know, for them, they said, look, I don't see this as dog whistle politics. They said that they just see it as a common political strategy, that if you have an opponent who is taking stances on something that's unpopular with voters or that you think is going to be unpopular, basically it's campaign malpractice not to highlight that. Definitely Booker is firmly on the record saying he supports reparations for slavery, which can include forms of recompense, such as the federal government providing direct payments to the descendants of enslaved people. In terms of defunding the police, that's actually something Booker hasn't, he has rarely spoken about that. When I interviewed him, he said that he basically did not express support for totally slashing police budgets, but he has criticized the ever increasing budgets that police get and suggested, you know, investing some of those resources elsewhere. But he says he specifically doesn't use that terminology, defund the police, because he doesn't want to play that game.
So I'm wondering what messaging Rand Paul might use. You know, Kentucky is unique. It's a small state compared to most of the other ones, but a great deal of people could probably name both of its U.S. senators. And Senator Mitch McConnell often argues, look, I'm in a powerful position as leader of the Republicans in the Senate, and I can bring a lot back to Kentucky because of that. And that's usually his main messaging, in addition, of course, to attacking his opponent. What's Rand Paul's messaging?
Well, he certainly is well known. Absolutely. I think a lot of his messaging is going to be clearly he's making it obvious that he's going to be using messaging about, you know, not supporting defunding the police. That's something I spoke to a political, you know, elections analyst who said, look, Republicans are throwing that out in absolutely every campaign, you know, trying to paint their opponent as being for defund the police and themselves as not being. But, you know, something that I think you'll see Senator Paul emphasize is going to be his approach to criminal justice and his desire for criminal justice reforms. That's something that was in Louisville talking about on the day that Booker launched his campaign. So I think that's going to be something he highlights a lot. I'm sure that you'll see him highlighting on some level his kind of approach to COVID. You know, he's had a lot of pretty prominent arguments with Dr. Anthony Fauci. So I'm sure you'll see stuff like that in terms of kind of him trying to show like what he's been up to over the last, you know, couple years.
And what about the messaging from Booker as it relates to Rand Paul when we think about how he might have waged a campaign directly against McConnell? Any differences or pretty much the same?
I think definitely there will be differences because, you know, Rand Paul is not Mitch McConnell. They have similarities, but they also take a different approach. You know, Rand Paul is someone who's a lot more, he's out there in the media a lot, really kind of rough and tumble, speaking his mind. And McConnell's a lot more careful about what he says, a little more of a, tries to project more of a very statesman-like focus. Booker and Paul, you know, I was talking to someone who said, look, the big thing with these guys is they're both not afraid to say what they think. They're both going to be very clear about their positions on things. And that's going to be a big part of this race, I think. Booker, really, though, one thing that you will see, I think, that you saw with him against McConnell was he talked a lot about how he said, look, Senator McConnell is not supporting policies that help people who are struggling with poverty, that help people who are working class. That was a big part of his message. And that's absolutely a big part of his message already against Senator Rand Paul, basically saying, look, his argument is Rand Paul wants to distract you from the fact that he is not supporting policies that are going to help you and your family put food on the table. So I think that's absolutely going to be a big part of Booker's pitch.
Morgan Watkins is with the Courier-Journal in Louisville. Morgan, I'm sure we'll have calls to talk again. I hope we do. There may even be a good Democratic primary to talk about. Thanks so much for the time you gave us today on this Friday.
Yeah, thank you.
And in northern Kentucky, river cities like Covington and Newport and Bellevue and Ludlow and Dayton are rediscovering their riverfront. But Newport, like Cincinnati, apparently won't see that large observation wheel that was expected. And an iconic Art Deco theater could be brought back if one new plan is seen through. Enquirer reporter Julia Fair is now with us. Julia, welcome back to our show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Our good buddy and your colleague at the Enquirer, Scott Wortman, was reporting earlier about the Cincinnati observation wheel. We might casually call Ferris wheel. Appears that might be somewhat doomed at this point. And is that true for Newport as well?
It looks like it. You know, in Newport, for the company to build the Ferris wheel that they were planning to build, they had to get a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. So the city got that permit for them, but then 2020 happened, and it just kept getting delayed. And now that permit, it expires at the end of July. So it doesn't look like it's going to be happening anytime soon. And if they do want to do it, they'll have to get a new permit. So it doesn't look good for the Ferris wheel on the northern Kentucky riverfront.
So at one point, it looked like we were going to have an embarrassment of riches in this region when it came to riverfront observation wheels, and now nothing?
Yep, it looks like it. Hopefully, you know, plans get revamped, but right now it doesn't look like either Ferris wheel is going to be built anytime soon.
Well, the good news is for people who do enjoy spending time on the riverfront in northern Kentucky is that a lot of projects have been taking shape in spite of the COVID-19 pandemic. We've seen a complete overhaul at Newport on the levee. We've seen Covington's riverfront finally get freshened up after many years of neglect with not a whole lot going on down there. You explored this on how northern Kentucky's river cities are reinventing their shores. And what did you find? Let's start with Covington, because that is the newest thing.
Yeah, so in Covington, the newest thing there is the plaza that they opened. It's a big amphitheater that has a view of the Cincinnati skyline, and they are going to host events there. I know there was a taco festival there. Some people were there was like a salsa festival there too. So it's really an entertainment attraction on Covington's riverfront. Covington is also in the process of trying to develop the IRS center that it bought. I believe that was in 2019. They're going to redevelop that into a mixed use development, which means there will be shops, there will be apartments, there will be a park, just really connecting the city back to the Ohio River in Covington.
Yeah, it seems that maybe people don't realize just how close the IRS Center is to the river because it's kind of swallowed up by that fast food district over there. But it's just on the other side of the hilly flood wall. So I've seen some renderings of some possibilities for that site that suggests, you know, connecting it to the riverfront is extraordinarily important. So we now have more recreation opportunities on the Covington side.
Yeah, that's right.
We have talked before on this program about dueling Ferris wheels, and those appear not to be happening. We've also talked about dueling music venues that are also popping up on both sides of the Ohio River. Those have come to fruition. What can you tell us about what's going on in Newport?
Yeah, so just in Newport, the Ovation music venue was just completed. It's going to host its first concert in September, so pretty soon. But what people may not realize is that that's just one part of the Ovation project. CorporX, based in Covington, is also going to build up to 1,000 residential units, retail space, a hotel, office space. And they are also going to hopefully build, like, revamp the park that's along the river. And when I spoke to Newport officials about this, they were also talking about how this project is really going to help them connect and reengage to the Ohio River. So in just a few years, Northern Kentucky's riverfront is going to look very different.
Indeed. So Bellevue and Dayton are also part of this. And a lot of this is connected to a project called Riverfront Commons, right? That connects all of the
yes.
Northern Kentucky River cities. It's an 11.5-mile river. Been in the works for many years. There have been parts of it completed in different parts of those cities, but it's not yet contiguous. What do we know about where that stands?
Yeah, so there is always an update coming to the Riverfront Commons project. As far as I know, it has been talked about for the past, I believe, 10 years. And so the new things that are coming to the Riverfront Commons project, which is really, it's a wide walking path that will connect like a few different river cities along the Northern Kentucky Riverfront. And so Dayton is working on an update. And I believe there was also, where was it? There's another path. Ludlow
yeah,
has
right.
another path.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that is coming up. And in Newport too, they are hoping to build a amphitheater that will be part of the Riverfront Commons area. It won't be a concrete amphitheater like Covington has, but Newport is looking forward to creating something like that because they just got a grant to contribute an amphitheater to the Riverfront Commons project.
We'll take us a little further down the river to Dayton, Kentucky, a city that is proudly named in honor of Dayton, Ohio. For those of you who don't know why the cities have the same names, it's because Dayton, Kentucky admired Dayton, Ohio so much that they adopted its name. That's not a joke. They have seen a boom in riverfront apartment construction.
Oh, yeah. Just in the past, 2 years, two new apartment complexes have opened up. So a lot of residential areas are coming to Dayton's riverfront. Aside from the apartment complexes, the Manhattan Harbor Project is still going along. That project started in the early 2000s, and they had plans to build $1 million homes there. Now the plans have kind of shifted, and now the homes that can be built there cost between $400,000 and $1 million. So still on the higher end, but there's a lot of residential projects happening on Dayton's riverfront. And Dayton is also hoping to build a street connector to make it easier for the people who live along the riverfront there to the downtown area in Dayton.
We're talking with Julia Fair, reporter at The Inquirer. Well, let's go back to Bellevue, but a little bit off the river, onto the main drag, mm-hmm. Fairfield Avenue. There is an old movie theater there, Art Deco style, the Marianne. I think that a lot of people around the region know it. It is a beautiful old Art Deco movie theater, but it hasn't shown a movie in about two decades. Everyone, Julia, has an idea for this building. Everyone knows what's going to work in there. Some people mm-hmm. have gotten pretty far with their ideas with the Marianne, only to see those dreams kind of fall through for various reasons. Mm-hmm. There is a new proposal. You wrote about it. Tell us what it is and who they are.
Yeah, so this new proposal comes from two independent filmmakers that live in Dayton, Kentucky, right next door to Bellevue, Kentucky. And they would like to buy it and turn it into the theater that it used to be. They would love to show independent films there. They want to bring comedians to perform there. Any kind of spoken art, they want to be able to have a place for that art to be shown to everybody. So these guys are really hoping to buy this from the city. The city owns the theater right now and rehab it into the theater that it used to be.
The city purchased it years ago, about 5 years ago, I guess, and then a developer came through and had done some successful projects with old properties in Cincinnati and mm-hmm. got pretty far in the process. That didn't work out. There was a proposal to turn it into condos. That was not received favorably. What are the chances for this one? Because even of the other two I just mentioned, this seems to bring in the least possible revenue.
Yeah, so I spoke to Bellevue's mayor, Charlie Cleaves, about this, and he did talk about how the biggest development challenge for this space has been parking. That has been a big concern. And then the other concern was like community pushback whenever somebody wanted to turn it into something that wasn't a theater. It really seemed like the community of Bellevue was asking the city to keep it a movie theater. And so he told me that since this theater, it's already a theater, it could be grandfathered in as use as still a theater. And with parking, he said parking might not be as big of a concern as like any of the other previous ideas to transform the space because people can walk to the theater. So he said, you know, I think saving the theater would be one of the coolest things. So, you know, it's not impossible. Is what I'll say.
Well, we will continue to watch, as everyone around there has been, for what might come of the Marianne, which has been vacant for about 20 years. I'm sure there are more stories to come on that. Julia Fair mm-hmm. is a Northern Kentucky reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Julia, thanks for spending some of your Friday with us. We really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks so much. Have a nice weekend.
You too. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A new documentary revisits the 2019 encounter on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., involving students from Covington Catholic, a Native American elder, and Black Hebrew Israelites. The event led to an international firestorm over the students' alleged behavior until further video evidence emerged contradicting much of the original narrative. One student, Nicholas Sandman, became the face of that encounter and ultimately sued multiple large media outlets for their coverage. The Boys in the Red Hats is running in a special engagement at the Esquire Theater, as well as other theaters around the country and virtually. Filmmaker Jonathan Schroeder, himself a Covington Catholic graduate, joins us now to talk about it. Jonathan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
I enjoyed watching the film, and I appreciate that you explored a variety of perspectives and topics. You had a lot of voices represented. And what really strikes me about this story more than 2 years later is that for a lot of people, the wounds that emerged from the coverage and the debates and the fights after, they seem to be pretty fresh still. Is that your sense as well?
Absolutely. If you go to our Facebook page, you will see random strangers arguing back and forth as if the event just happened yesterday. There's something about that smirk, about the situation, that just it's a very visceral reaction that people are having.
It managed to, in one image, and the most famous image from it, of course, is the face of Covington Catholic student Nicholas Sandman mm-hmm. smiling with a Make America Great Again hat on, one of the hats, the red hats in support of President Donald Trump, and the face of Native American, Nathan Phillips. And that's what we know. And in that moment, it captured Trump politics. It captured racial politics. The event captured media biases. It got celebrities involved. It got white privilege involved. I mean, this was all of the issues summed up in one massive event. So what exactly made you want to try to break this down as best you could?
Well, when I first saw the video, I, like so many other Americans, had a very visceral reaction to it. And honestly, my reaction to it was horrible. I was so infuriated at that kid, and I was embarrassed of my school. So for the first time in my life, I became a keyboard warrior. I started, you know, arguing back and forth with my classmates. I was tweeting. But when I learned what really happened a few days later, the kids, to me, were completely exonerated. They were basically innocent bystanders, and they were approached by Black Hebrew Israelites. They were approached by Nathan Phillips Group, and all of which was reported inaccurately by the media. They chose to go with immediacy over accuracy, and I did a complete 180. And it was at that point that I wanted to make a documentary, because I wanted to give the viewer the emotional journey that I went on when I watched the video and learned what actually happened.
And while you do that, you do explore a culture at Covington Catholic, which is very proud. In fact, pride itself is mentioned throughout the film. They have a raucous athletic support group, right? I mean, the crowds, the student crowds at athletic events are very loud, very choreographed. It's really quite impressive. And, you know, they are the envy of a lot of other schools. So they receive a lot of scorn, and you explore how often they respond to that scorn from other schools with those chants that we, in the longer videos from the National Mall, began to see them perform. But what I thought was particularly interesting was you talked to Cincinnati Board of Education member Mike Morosky in this film, and he had made some comments against those Covington Catholic students at that time. And even after seeing the longer videos emerge, he stood by those claims.
Absolutely. And I think most people, you're either on one side or you're on the other side. And the point of my documentary is there doesn't have to be sides. And if there are sides, you draw a line down the middle, at least have the empathy to listen to someone who is, in fact, still offended by that incident. You know, Mike was the moderator last night, and Mike Morosky does not pull any punches.
Yeah, you're talking about a premiere that took place at the Esquire Theater, right?
Yes.
And that will be running for a couple of weeks at the Esquire Theater, and we've got details on that at WVXU.org. Inside the Cincinnati Edition tab, you talk to a variety of people, including local journalists and some local attorneys. One student did participate in the conversation, although you did conceal his identity out of fears that still linger for a lot of these folks. But one really interesting aspect of your exploration of the culture at Covington Catholic was your own experience. You were a football player. You seemed to enjoy your time there. And then something bad happened to you, literally at the hand of a teacher. Would you mind sharing that story with our audience?
Well, at first, I did not want to be in the documentary at all. I just wanted to do a little bit of voiceover. But luckily, some very close friends of mine, some filmmaker friends of mine, really convinced me to insert myself into the documentary. And honestly, I have no aspirations to be the next Michael Moore. But in this documentary, I did put myself in it. I took the advice of my friends and I owned it. So I wanted to give the viewer an idea of Covington Catholic. I wanted to put my story of going to Covington Catholic into the film. So one of the most memorable things that happened to me at Covington Catholic was a very respected, almost legendary teacher punched me in the forehead in the middle of class, and it nearly knocked me out. In the film, I had a lump on my head so big that I could barely put my football helmet on when it came time to practice. But that's part of my story at Covington Catholic. That was part of my journey. And, it was tough to put in there. To this day, that was probably the best teacher that I've ever had. And to this day, I love that guy. But it's kind of like, it's like a family member. You can love your parent or your mom or your dad or whoever else. They can do something borderline abusive. But at the end of the day, you still have that respect and love for them. I had a problem just criticizing Covcath in general.
Why?
Being a former colonel, you want to defend your institution, and there's so much pride there. So, I took no joy out of criticizing Covington Catholic.
But you did explore some of the criticisms of it. We'll get towards the end a little bit more about, how this probably didn't even need to be a story to begin with. It was so, just another day in Washington, D.C., really, had it not been for the very short clip that emerged on social media that mischaracterized what was taking place there. But there were other things about Covington Catholic that came out as people sought to explore the culture there. And there were accusations that students engaged in blackface at basketball games. And so images started to circulate in the school, and its defenders would come out and say, look, this was a blackout night. Students have blue out nights, white out nights. They dress from head to toe and sometimes paint their faces. Now, they painted their faces black in some of those blackout faces. You pointed something out that I hadn't seen before, because I saw the defense that this is a blackout night. We painted our faces black to be black from head to toe. It may have been tone deaf. It may have been disrespectful unknowingly, but this is why we did it. You pointed out an image that was a flat out reference to blackface with the whiteness around the lips and the whiteness around the eyes. I had never seen that image before. How did that make you feel as a Covington Catholic graduate?
No, it's embarrassing. I don't know if there was an ignorance to it. I want to believe that the kids had no idea that they were mimicking minstrel shows, which they have big exaggerated eyes and lips. I probably would have left that alone had they not applied the white makeup with the big eyes and lips. But you're right, that's so completely tone deaf. And for, you know, the faculty, the chaperones, the parents, if you have a white kid and you see them walking out the door with a black face and big exaggerated eyes and lips, you have to have the common sense to say, you know, in these times, that is so disrespectful. Go wash your face. I'm cool with blue outs and white outs, but, you know, painting your face black is offensive to so many people on so many levels.
You know, as a local journalist, both here on the radio and the publisher of a newspaper in Covington that covered this, I feel like after the event and the dust started to settle a little bit, that I reflected and learned from the event about my business and how to approach it, you know, the industry of journalism. I heard in your documentary from a locally based writer who published an article in The Atlantic about how she had learned from the experience. There are various people who reflected on the experience. What did you learn?
Well, sitting across from someone who's really criticizing Covington Catholic, who's criticizing me, it was really difficult at times. You know, same from the CovCast side. There was a lot of times where I'm interviewing someone and I'm literally squirming in my seat. There was other times I literally wanted to tackle the person I was asking questions to because it was just so relentless. But it forced me to listen, which I know a lot of people are great talkers, but I don't think many people really listen to what someone who has opposing views has to say. So it really benefited me, not only as a person, but as a filmmaker.
The Boys in the Red Hats is now available at various theaters across the country, including here at the Esquire on a limited engagement, a special engagement. It's also available virtually. We've got a link for more information at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. Jonathan, you're getting some reviews in major publications. How do you feel about it?
I don't know how to feel about it. It's borderline surreal. I made this movie with five or six people. It was all, you know, independent film, friends and family. My wife helped out. She's a producer on the film. So for a tiny, 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 minuscule little movie to get that sort of national recognition, it's humbling.
Jonathan Schroeder is the director behind the new film, The Boys in the Red Hats, a documentary revisiting the Covington Catholic students' encounter on the National Mall with Black Hebrew Israelites and Native American Nathan Phillips. Jonathan, thank you so much for taking some time with us. Good luck with the film. I hope we get to talk again.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Find more episodes online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.